Welcome to Sex with Simmery. Frank, occasionally explicit edutainment on the most important topic of all. Sex with Simmery is not intended for children and is not safe for work unless your boss is particularly awesome. See more at sexwithsimmery.com. Welcome to Sex with Simmery. This is Dr. Timmery, and I am pleased as punch to introduce to you a guest who I have previously gotten to work with and now I'm excited to welcome to the show, Dr. Susanna Mayer. Welcome.
Thank you, and I'm totally honored to be here.
Yay. So some of you who listen might recall we did an episode a few months ago that was at the Noir Literature Conference that was about burlesque. And Dr. Mayer was the what you just ran the joint? Like
I don't know. I was in charge. I pointed fingers and everybody else talked.
There was some whoosh, and everyone was like, "Yes, ma'am." And then clothes strewn everywhere. No. So what brought you to that Noir conference? Like what
brought me to that Noir conference?
I never know where I go.
Actually, one of the attendees at my salon had mentioned it and said, please connect with the person that put it together, whose name I've just went out the window. But I did. And in all honesty, I expected to do something very different. I'm not sure what I expected to do, but I really didn't anticipate that. And he put together the topic, and then I had to play with it from there. And that's fun. I like to curate things like that. So I suggested people he should speak with. Some people panned out. Some people worked out. And in the end, it was wonderful. I think I put it all together 3 days beforehand.
Nice. And so speaking of the salon and speaking of your acumen for curation, etc., one of your claims to fame is that you founded and you are the host of the Erotic Literary Salon. So what that's for anybody who doesn't already know.
Well, that is a space where people actually, I'm going to go back to the very beginning as to why I created it and what it has actually become in the 5 years, 5 year anniversary this May.
Oh my.
May 21st. It started because I had these focus groups and workshops for postmenopausal women. And I was suggesting that they find their turn on something, you know, visual or something they could read. And they were all up in arms. These women just threw the word feminist at me as if I didn't know what it was or I wasn't one. And I was appalled. I couldn't believe it. And what I realized after finding out their definition of feminism and who they got their stories from, They were radical feminists, but they heard the rant of the radical feminists back in the 60s and the 90s when they went up in front of the Mies Commission and talked about pornography and how horrific it was, and how it was changing our society. So they couldn't imagine reading erotica because for them, erotica and pornography were synonymous. And basically, on some level, it is. It just depends on how you want to qualify it.
So they felt that pornography, erotica, anything in that genre was somehow going to be objectifying to women, was inherently going to be damaging to women?
Totally damaging to women. And it wasn't going to turn. And I realized with that mindset, it's not going to turn them on.
Oh, yeah. Well,
yeah. So maybe. That wasn't going to be their turn on. There's no way they were going to watch anything or read anything that was spicy on any level, because it didn't matter whether it was going to be degrading for women, because as far as they were concerned, if there was a spicy or raunchy word or racy word anywhere, it's demeaning, period. And I wasn't going to change their head trip. I realized that by just talking to them. And I thought the only thing I could do was to somehow create a space where people could come and enjoy this erotica and mainstream it. Because once you mainstream something, it's really hard to go back and say, oh, this is terrible, if everybody's enjoying it.
Well, what do you mean by mainstream?
Well, mainstream, Fifty Shades of Grey, just mainstreamed erotica, okay. Real fast. Okay.
But I have a connotation in my mind. Mainstreaming tends to be pejorative. Like by mainstreaming, it then takes away the edge. It makes it less potent and more palatable.
Well, I guess with that definition, it probably wouldn't work, but that is not my definition.
That's not what you meant. Okay, so what were you trying to do for
erotica? My definition really just wanted to make it less shameful.
Okay.
Just get rid of the shame.
Okay.
And that's really all I wanted to do. And so I was taking erotica, in a sense, out of the bedroom and putting it into the public. And originally I had planned to do this just for women. I always feel that if you have a group of women dealing with a certain subject, or you have a group of men and women dealing with a certain subject, you get very different answers. You get mm-hmm. very different responses. You get a very different scene. But the place I had originally planned on doing it, and I did for about a year and a half, was L'Etage. It's a public space. And in being a public space and a bar, I was not allowed to have just women only. It had to be open to the public.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't renting the space specifically for me. It was an open bar. So they could not discriminate against men. So all of a sudden, within a week, it turned into both, inviting for both men and women. And it was small. Oh, I would say the first time maybe 25 people attended. And it was almost a true salon in the sense that people came with their partially finished works and they wanted to be critiqued, or even smaller pieces. Maybe 10 people signed up to read, giving us time to discuss and talk about pieces. One man came with just a scene, a sex scene from his novel, and he wanted to know whether the characters were believable, and we all decided they weren't. And it was very interesting discussion because, I'm trying to remember now, I'm going back 5 years, it was a female character, protagonist, who was a student at MIT, and her boyfriend was looking at porn, and she was Indian from India and a Christian, and her boyfriend was looking at porn. It was very complicated, which was okay, but the part wasn't believable was her responses to all of whatever was going on. I honestly don't remember what it was, other than in the audience happened to be an Indian woman who was Christian. And so, from her perspective was, no, this girl would never respond that way based on religion. So we really delved very deeply, not just on a sexual level, but on a sociological level. And it was fun. I really loved it. Until one day, a woman who was a dom, and I knew that, she let everyone know that, came in, and she was a little pissed at me. Because she didn't read a directive that I had given about a week prior to the salon.
She only likes giving instructions. She's only taking them.
You got it. And I just suggested if people weren't sure what they wanted to write about, I made a suggestion, and I don't even remember what it was that I suggested.
Are these like themes?
Yeah, it was a theme, but it wasn't one that you had to follow. It was more like a suggestion. If you hadn't come up with something, here's a theme, I'll throw it out. So she comes, and because she hadn't written anything, and I still allow people to read other people's works. It doesn't happen often, but sometimes. She came in with the raunchiest scene that she took from the internet, and she performed it unbelievably well. It was hysterical. She had us laughing, and she thought I would be pissed. I thought it was wonderful.
Like she was trying to get back at you, like,
right.
I'll show you. I'm going to be sexy. You're going to be so mad.
And it was great. It taught me a lesson. It made me realize that people actually wanted to be entertained. And she did it. She did a great job. So that was one turning point. The next turning point, well, Leithaj has a sort of like a stage.
It's like you a quasi stage.
Yeah, quasi stage. But it's stage enough that inhibits some people who are not used to reading, and especially not used to reading erotica, to get up there. So when I sort of got kicked out of that space, and that had more to do with the manager just not appreciating us, I found a much better space for my needs, even closer to home, at the Bohemian Absinthe Lounge, which is on the second floor of Time Restaurant. It's owned by Time.
I didn't even know that was the name of that place. I've really been there and had no idea.
Isn't that a great name?
That is amazing.
Because I serve absinthe.
I immediately wanted to go there. I heard the name and I'm like, let's go. What are we still doing here?
It's a great place. And there's no stage, so everybody's sort of on equal footing, literally. And it seats more people, even though it doesn't feel like a larger space. It is. So 65 people get seated, and anywhere from 10 to 30 people stand at any given month, because we've been overflowing. And by moving to that space and getting my PhD, because I got my PhD late in life. I got it in 2009.
High five. So did I.
Oh, good.
No, mine was 2010. I'm a liar. I'm a liar.
I was going to say it's a good year.
You
well,
totally beat me.
Beat you by a few years, too. In any case, the Inquirer and the Daily News claimed it had nothing to do with my PhD, but they totally ignored me for a year prior to that, almost a year and a half, until I got it. And then within a month of each other came to the salon, interviewed me.
So it added like a sense of legitimacy or something?
Oh,
like,
absolutely. That PhD did everything. It was all the difference. It was amazing. And the Inquirer, the day that it came out, we had a 3-foot snowstorm, so nobody even read it. I mean, it didn't even come out that day. It didn't even make a difference. And it was full page. And it was a really nice, it was surprisingly nice. I was expecting some negativity. And
from that particular outlet, but yeah, I would definitely not have been surprised.
It happened to be, I can't remember the reporter's name, but she was an Indian woman. I remember that. I remember, oh gosh, on that particular night, I never know what's going to get read. I censor absolutely nothing, which astounds people, of course. And it just happened to be one of those really raunchy days out of nowhere. It just turned into it. And I could see her squirming. She was not comfortable listening to it. It was a black man had come, and he had actually read at one of the first salons, hadn't seen him for a while. Maybe he got wind that the Inquirer was coming and wanted to be on. That wouldn't surprise me. Talked about his escapades in Germany, seeing how many men he could pick up in one evening, and described in great detail what they did. And it was very interesting. So I probably shouldn't have, but I apologized to her at intermission just a wee bit, saying, you know, it's not, I never know what it's going to be. It's rare that it gets really that raunchy. It didn't feel like literature. It was his journal. And she looked at me almost offended that I had said that to her. And she said, well, I wasn't. You know, that was fine with me. And I'm thinking, no, it wasn't. But maybe because I said what I did, her report, her story was great. She didn't want to, you know, show that it...
She maybe just liked it. I mean, I think, you know, one of the conversations I've had with people around talking about sexuality, talking about sex and comedy, you know, like anytime you're having like a very public conversation where one person's doing the talking and a lot of people are listening. I find like I personally am hardly ever, ever, ever offended. But I start getting squirmy because I'm worried about somebody else being offended. And I don't know what that is about. Like, I'm worried that, like, oh, that you know, person over there, I'm going to make these assumptions about how they're going to react to this, like, totally, you know, I'm thinking of this one. We were actually at a fundraiser for the Slut Walk that this comedian goes up there and he's talking about going down on, like, geriatric women. And I just, like, I personally wasn't offended, but I was just, like, so worried for, like, the 70-year-old woman who was sitting next to me. I was like, I'm just, like, assuming she's not into it, but maybe she loved it. I don't know.
Well, in this case, I was reading her body language.
Okay.
And I could have been wrong, but her body language, I was watching her squirm. Okay. There was not a comfort zone
maybe
around her.
Maybe she wanted to be cool with it. But just, like,
who knows? I don't know. But it was nice. And the Daily News the following month did a page and a half.
Okay.
And I was totally impressed. I have never, ever had a reporter say anything negative. I think there was one time that a blogger at the end said everything wonderful, other than at the end, I'm not so sure I could do this more than once every once in a while. And I'm thinking, why not? Why can't you do this monthly? There are a lot of people that do this monthly. And actually, I emailed them and mentioned that. But that,
I mean, it's like roller coasters. I mean, like, I can get down with a roller coaster, but I don't do that every day.
Right.
Maybe that's what it is.
This event is only once a month. There's a community of people that come regularly. There's a community of people that come irregularly. And then there's always what we call them virgins, the newbies that come. And because I have them clap to sort of distinguish who they are, I pretty much know about 70% are repeats and 30% are newbies, which is a nice ratio to have. Moving into the new space, because I could easily bring in more people and those newspaper clippings did, the other thing that jumped my attendance from the average was 40, 45, almost doubled it, were some meetup groups that decided they wanted to make my event a monthly event for them to go to. So several meetups come and meet. Passports to Pleasure is really one of the biggies. And then I have an erotic literary salon meetup also. So now it's an average of 70, 75 people that come monthly, and that sometimes jumps up to 105.
So what is the vibe like? I mean, obviously you were talking about someone who appeared to be not necessarily having that phenomenal of a time, but, like, are most people just, like, chilled and relaxed? Are they obviously turned on? Like, what?
Well, it's interesting. The age is 20. They have to be 21 because it's in a bar. And if my mom shows up, she's my chosen mom, it goes up to 96. She's not there in the winter time. So it goes up to probably my age, and I'm in my mid-60s. I would say it's heavily strewn between the 25 to 45 range. Who shows up? Absolutely everybody. I mean, everybody from somebody being totally tattooed and pierced to the three-piece business suit that just walked in the door, because the doors open at 6:30. All different ethnic groups, all different identities, genders. It's a really all-inclusive group. And I know it is because I get the feedback, not just my visual of people saying to me, I have never attended any kind of event with this kind of a mix, and a supportive mix. Anyone who gets up to read, especially if they're a virgin, if they've never read before, gets a round of applause even before they start speaking, and then clearly afterwards. Nobody has ever been booed, ever. I mean, clearly you're not going to like everything, but nobody, I mean, the type of environment sort of brings you in, like the cattle effect. Everybody is acting a certain way, and you dare not act any differently than that.
So this immediately makes me wonder, if someone were to come up there, either with the intention to or without meaning to, could it be possible to cross some sort of line? Like, if somebody wrote about something that people found, like, just, like, they want to be supportive and all, but, like, I'm just taking random stabs in the dark about animals, about children, or about something exceptionally violent, or, like, are there any taboos?
Well, there are no taboos.
Okay.
Because it's not in print.
Okay.
So I censor nothing. There was only one time, and this is when the salon was still few people, few being about 25 to 45 people, where we had the opportunity to banter back and forth. This one woman with a pretty strong British accent, so kind of falls at the end of the sentence. You didn't hear her that well, and this was at L'Etage, and the sound system wasn't great. So people didn't hear her backstory. Backstory is given to all stories, either before people speak or afterwards. That's one of the highlights of the salon. People talk about the motivation for writing the piece or anything that would help the audience understand the piece more. And she mentioned that the piece she was about to read was partially autobiographical, but that word partially didn't get heard by a lot of people. Also, people like to hear
what they want to hear.
We know that. So she read a piece about it sort of read like she was reading a journal about a rape when she was a teenager and an almost rape when she was in her 40s. And when she got done, you could sort of hear a pin drop. People were just like, it was so heartfelt. And somebody commented that they were overcome by how she really shared such personal material. And then she said, well, I just need to reiterate that it's partially autobiographical. Well, that created havoc because people felt they had been duped. Mm. And in being, it did matter that it had to do with rape, but the fact that they were duped made it even worse. They didn't want it, have it said. They were so invested in it, and now all of a sudden they lost that investment, even though she had been actually raped as a teenager, but the scene when she was in her 40s didn't actually occur. So they were very angry. But other than that, and I'm going to take it back, one other gentleman came up and read a Lolita-style piece that he had written, and people couldn't understand. They felt that there should be no erotica when it came to, well, this was an incestuous piece, in fact, and they felt erotica didn't belong in there and that people would not get turned on by that. And clearly people get turned on by all sorts of things. So that's when I come in with my voice and talking about that, discussing, especially with the first piece, why this woman wrote her piece about rape and how there are people that write about rape who have been raped. They use it as a way to overcome that. They're now in control. Their pen is in control of how they feel afterwards. So there are a lot of positive ways to deal with erotica, not just listening to it, but writing it. Where was I? I just went off on a tangent here.
Taboo in general. And like,
yeah, taboo.
Obviously, but not everyone's going to like everything.
They
That's
certainly
impossible.
Are not. But the truth is, everything has been read at the salon. Some of it incredibly well written. Others, you kind of feel that somebody wrote it down in 30 seconds because they just wanted to get up there and read. That's rare. Although there's one woman, Monica Day, who her backstories quite often are, I knew I wanted to read, so I wrote this on the bus coming here. And she is this phenomenal writer that I always get pissed. I go, you know, it takes me months to write that, and you did it on the bus coming here, you know.
Jerk.
Yeah, yeah. But so it's all over the place. And what's really nice and what I've noticed in the past year, because the space is so safe, so comfortable, so supportive, people are using it as a space to come out. And we're not talking about coming out to be gay. We're talking about people coming out, changing their identities, finding as they write, as they go through life, that maybe really they're not as male as they thought they were, or vice versa. And they have basically said to me, it's because of the atmosphere of the salon that they feel comfortable doing that. Not only saying, but sometimes coming and dressing.
Well, there's just not... I mean, I'm hearing this tale of this space where you can go and there's literally just total freedom as long as everybody is like respectfully following, you know, basic like one person at a time sort of rules. But that, I mean, how many people at any point in their life get to legitimately have that level of expression? And I mean, you could have a great deal of freedom in so many different artistic forms, in music and comedy and in dance, etc., but there's always some sort of reining back in because you have to, you know, you have to still be in a certain time or you have to, you know, still make people laugh, etc. But this sounds like abject freedom. It's kind of amazing.
Total freedom, other than it has to be within 5 minutes.
Oh, okay.
And you have to keep your clothes on.
Oh.
I know. Tommy D, Naked Man, comes down from Chelsea, New York, quite often. And every time he comes, because he is an exhibitionist, he asks, once again, can I take my clothes off? And I remind him, no, I'm really sorry, you have to be fully clothed. But there's something about that. There is a comfort in knowing somebody is not going to take their clothes off, because these quite often are people who are not interested in seeing people take their clothes off. They're there for the literature, for the words. Although I do, and I have had burlesque dancers come, there are quite often people leave when they get up to dance, you know, and it's usually been at the end.
Oh, so they're performing dance as opposed to reading.
Right. They're not reading.
Okay. Well, it's a very different thing. And it's, you know, it's interesting because right. You mentioned at the beginning that for the women you were speaking to, that they sort of classified erotica and porn in the same general category. But they're so fundamentally different because erotica takes place entirely in your brain. And
well,
then,
you know, it's interesting. I can't remember. It was very early on in the salon. I read an email. I don't really write, although all my people say, of course you're a writer, you've done things, but I don't consider myself a writer per se. So I just shared an email exchange with a lover I had, and I got his permission. And it was pretty out there. It was very out there. And then other people started reading, and somewhere as the night wore on, one of the newer attendees said, wait a minute, I thought this was an erotica salon, and I'm just hearing pornography. Hmm. And I went, okay, so we now have to go for definition. And I thought, what better way than to make an example? And I asked people, how many people felt the nonfiction piece I read, which was an email exchange, was erotic, and how many people felt it was pornographic, because it was extremely graphic. 3/4 of the people felt it was erotic, and 1/4, or maybe it was 2/3, and then 1/3 felt it was pornographic. And then I kind of lied to them, and I said, well, you know, I said it was nonfiction, but I made it up. Ah, the numbers changed. Half of the erotica people then felt it was pornographic. And we realized it had not only content, but intent.
That's fascinating. And, yes. And like, the thing that is catching in my mind is, like, pornography to me has to have a visual depiction. Like, that is my definition of it. Like, for me, it's not about intent or, like, is it high class enough. For me, it's like the word itself, graph, like in there, says that there has to be a visual representation. So to me, it could never be pornographic because it is not a picture. It is not a visual. But these are things that every single person evidently is having a very different reading of.
Right. And I must admit, erotica can be very visual. So I'm not sure that your definition would hold up on that.
I agree that erotica can, like, there can be, like, erotic film, erotic pictures, etc. But, like, to me, like, the definition of porn, mm-hmm. like, that specifically, I think that the word porn is more limited than erotica.
Well, you know, you can ask 10 different people
and get a bunch to of
define,
answers, yeah.
And you will get lots of... Marion Beck, Mariana Beck. I needed to use a definition for my dissertation, and I used her definition, and I should have brought it here because it's quite lengthy. But it really talks about how these definitions change with the actual times and what is acceptable and not acceptable. Because what we would maybe consider pornographic now, or not pornographic now, would have been considered highly pornographic 30 or 40 years ago. You know, if you had read things about homosexuality back 40, 50 years ago, that in itself would have been considered pornographic. And now, you know, it's mainstreamed at this point.
Okay.
So this, it changes. It yeah. really does.
And one of the things you talked about earlier, and this is kind of a big jump backwards, about the guy trying to figure out if his characters were realistic. And he was talking about the Christian Indian MIT student,
mm-hmm.
Which is fascinating because I wonder if you have anything to say about gender and how the gender of a writer affects their ability to tap into realistically capturing the beliefs and the desires and the reactions and the thoughts of their characters based on gender.
Well,
if there's any sort of
I've seen people do, you know, sort of studies on the side, and there are also a lot of erotica writers who go by different gender names. Mm-hmm. So you think you're reading something written by a male and it's actually been written by a female and vice versa. I've given out directives. Sometimes I make suggestions at the salon because it's hard to come up with what am I going to write if you're not a writer. And I'll tell people to write from a different voice, a totally different voice. If you're female, write from a male perspective and vice versa. And they do it really well. Not an issue. In this man's case, it was more that he didn't do enough research into the Indian culture and the Christian Indian culture per se. Not so much that he was writing a female voice. I think that was the issue.
But do you think that most writers are equally good at tapping into the processes for
I don't know. I can't honestly say. I think everybody has their own specialty. I mean, there are women that all they write is male-to-male homoerotica.
Mm-hmm.
It's a genre. It's a subgenre. Women are writing about men with men.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a whole group of women that's all they read. That's what turns them on.
Yeah. I'm well aware. And yeah. There's a fair number of slash fiction subgenres completely filled with women.
And lots of subgenres out there.
How much, speaking of slash fiction, how much slash is there that shows up at yours where it's characters from TV shows or a comic or...
You know, honestly, unless they tell me it in their backstory, I wouldn't know because I don't actually watch television.
Okay.
that's not a good thing to say, but... And I'm just trying to remember if somebody's done that as a backstory.
Or any, like, Twilight.
And I haven't noticed. Honestly, boy, I'm going to go to the next salon. They're going to say, wait a minute, you forgot me. Of course I write that all the time. But I'm not remembering any. I really don't. Yeah.
Two guys from Supernatural. I'm just talking about what I find on Tumblr, mostly.
You know, every month it's so different. 2 months ago, there's usually one man that tends to like to read first, and he's a bit of a comedian, but he wasn't there. And so on the last minute, I asked a woman who I know is a really good writer to read, and she said, well, I got to tell you, I have a rant. I said, sure, start with a rant. And that, I mean, it's not like it will set the pace for the evening, because people have their works out there already. They're not going to write rants and then put it out there. You have to sign up in advance. But it did set an interesting tone nonetheless. So she did her rant, and the last piece also happened to be a rant, totally different. I can't even tell you what they were other than they were rants. So, you know, and these were women. And what I find is women, the comfort zone is such that women will read out of the box. Women will read what society doesn't normally anticipate and expect them to write. And men will do the opposite. So you'll get a woman ranting in a very raunchy way, and you'll get a man being unbelievably romantic and seductive with his words. Now, this is not all the time. This is not 100%, but it's not uncommon. Because of the safety of the space, that people aren't going to pass any judgment. No judgment is ever passed there. At least I haven't heard anything, and certainly by their responses, I haven't felt any judgment. So there's an incredible amount of comfort.
Interesting. So we've been just focusing on the literary salon, which obviously we could talk about for a
long
great
time.
While. But I want to talk a little bit more about you and your background. And you mentioned your doctorate. And so you're a consultant and educator and a relationship mentor. So aside from the salon, you've got a whole other
life
list of sexuality stuff that we should definitely tap into. Relationship mentor is an absolutely interesting choice as opposed to counselor. Is there a...
Well, I'm not a counselor and I'm not a coach.
Okay.
It's not my style. It's not how I work with people. And I realized as I sat down and was putting my business cards together, because my former business cards only said consultant and sex educator, because I do. People come to me and I educate them. Most of the time, people know very little about sexuality when they come into my office. But then I realized they're not just coming one time. They're coming for a period of time, especially if they're coming as a couple. And I realized I'm not coaching them, because coaching has a specific style to it, and I'm much more proactive when I work with people than just get them to decide what the next move is going to be. And so as I thought about what people do when they're being mentored in a business, it's pretty much what I do. When I work with people, I've been in two very, well, fairly long-term relationships, officially married 11 years, unofficially married 20 years. The woman I live with, my chosen mom, was married for 64 years. I also interviewed a lot of couples at one time. I was thinking of writing a book, and I may still, of people who have been together over 50 years. So I interviewed a lot of couples. So I not only know about relationships from my personal relationships, but what has worked for other people, because I was really looking for that thread of what works. And I realized people need mentors. people had mentors at one time. It was usually a close relative or family that lived nearby that if they were having issues, they would see them. Or they had best friends who were, you know, usually two couples, three couples, four couples would do things together all the time. That's not happening now. We have a mobile community, you know, society where we're not living in the same neighborhood with the same people for decades.
I literally don't know my neighbors. Like, I know the lady that lives next door's first name. And that's about the extent of it. I'm listening to the story. I'm like, that is absolutely true. Like,
yeah. So we need somebody who we can sort of look to for advice, basically, because that's what I hand out. Advice with a lot of information that has to do with sexuality. And what I find, when you peel back the onion, people, I get, I'd say a majority of my clients come from psychologists or gynecologists who are dealing with couples where they've peeled back the onion and all of a sudden the psychologist realizes the couple walked in, their issue was money, but now they realize it may have started out as money, but it's become a sexual issue. Or they came in with some very trite problem, but when the onion got peeled back, it really had to do with sex.
Yeah, money was the facade for what it meant underneath. Right. Yeah.
And, or sometimes it may not have been the facade, but they dealt with that issue and now they're comfortable talking about sexuality, but the psychologist is not comfortable talking about it. They're not schooled in it. And a really good psychologist will send them to a sexologist. I've also had people, you know, when I've done workshops or I've listened to people who tell me what their gynecologist, I mean, just recently I was asked to take part in a small workshop for older adults. They were actually swingers who were in their 60s and 70s. And one woman said, well, I saw my gynecologist and, you know, he told me that, forget it, you know, I'm postmenopausal, it's never going to be the same.
Forget what?
Right. And now here's a woman who's a swinger. She's not about to forget her recreation that now is not the way it used to be. True, like, but...
You forget it. You forget it, gynecologist. You forget about it. I got to go do some stuff.
And I just sat in this workshop and a lot of expletives came out of my mouth because I found that so hard to believe. And then I realized, why should I find this hard to believe? Most doctors get 13 hours of human sexuality courses if they want to take them. Mm. Those are optional. They don't know anything. I mean, they know about the pathology. Pleasure, that's not in any books they read.
No, I mean, this is a recurring thing we talk about on the show is like that for very many folks, their number one source of information when they have like a sexual question is they go to their primary physician who has no idea.
Right.
But they'll probably have an opinion on the matter because they're a person and most people have opinions on sexual matters. And so, you know, I will often get letters from people who are like, well, my gynecologist told me this. And I'm like, yeah, it's just some shaming bullshit. That's not actually
right.
True. Factual information. So,
and the other place women go, and I don't know what the percentage is, but it's really out there, is to whoever's selling them sex toys. You know, the home sex toy places.
Yeah.
That I believe Kinsey did a study on that, and that's where most women go for their information. And people who run these parties don't know very much information.
They have to be certified to do that job.
And they don't have the proper answers.
I do know some, you know, sexuality grad students who do that as a job for a while,
right.
But they are certainly not the majority.
Right.
And you would just be incredibly lucky to stumble upon like a PhD somebody candidate that,
yeah.
Who's like, and then this is going to go up here to the left and you're going to get a little bit of that situation. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, where were we? What was your question? Did I answer?
We're just talking about your sexology practice in general.
So my It's education. Mm-hmm. A lot of it has to do with education. I'll get a couple who comes in and has no idea how to use a toy or anything about lubes or the difference between lube and moisturizers. Ah. I mean, you know.
Ouch.
Yeah.
That stings. Ah. Yeah. No. No lotion in there. No.
Well, it depends on the moisturizer. You haven't been taught about moisturizer. Well, see, you're not of the age where you need to use a moisturizer.
Okay. All right. That's valid. That's valid. I mean, I'm familiar with, like, there's the little dissolving little bubble things that can be inserted, and they just sort of, like, they dissolve with your body heat, and then it, like, sort of creates
a moisture.
Internally. Yeah. I'm familiar with that.
But that's not considered a lubricant. That's considered a moisturizer, because moisturizers, and these are specifically moisturizers that they don't use on your face. Okay. They just are used internally.
Yeah, my head went to like Johnson. Right,
I realized, like, as I said that, who I'm speaking to age-wise. Clearly not postmenopausal. You use moisturizers during the week, depending on how often you need them. Quite, you know, average maybe twice a week, but that really does vary with each woman. And they're not used prior to intercourse. These are something that you use the way you would use moisturizer on your face, as opposed to if you think of the lube being, let's say, makeup. You only use that when you're going out.
Okay. This is an interesting analogy.
I guess I just came up with that analogy. No, I don't know if it works. Yeah. But
one is about basic maintenance. Right. And one is about on-the-spot situation.
Exactly. So your moisturizer is keeping you moist on a regular basis. And then just before intercourse or at some point, you will use a lube either on your clitoris or even internally. So it's that combination, because postmenopausal women tend to need more moisture. Even though they may be wet as anything, and that's what throws a lot of these women off, when I tell them to touch it, they kind of look at me like, what do you mean you want me to touch this stuff? But once they get over it, they realize that the viscosity has changed. Even though they're equally as wet, some of them, the viscosity is very thin when your hormone level, specifically estrogen, is down. So that's why you need all those moisturizers and lubes. Definitely not the one you put on your face.
You know what's amazing is I think that this was the most helpful little segment on post-menopausal sexual changes that I took classes specifically on, you know, like...
And they didn't talk about this?
Aging and sexuality. I mean, we did, but in very, like, amorphous, vague terms. And I think that, like, like all the things you're saying, like connect things that I knew, but like this specific, that analogy is just
the
real
analogy.
Killer. Just
oh,
real
okay.
Killer.
I'll have to remember that analogy.
Yeah, like I think there's just this sort of like, well, here's the deal. When you get older, it's going to start sucking. Like stuff's just going to get harder, except for the things that you want to be harder. It's going to take longer for it to get harder, and then it won't stay as hard as you want it to for as long. And like that's just sort of like, just understand that things aren't going to work the way that they used to, and you're going to have to be more creative. Like that's sort of the general tenor of how we discuss it, not necessarily as practical as
I'm
that.
I'm the practical lady.
Yeah, that was a nice practical rundown.
Well, good. So now you know what. Although by time you go through your postmenopause, life will be probably totally different. Who knows?
Probably.
You know,
space lubes. They just like you push a button on your watch and you're good. That'll
Who knows?
Be you'll like
Who
text
knows?
Yourself and then shoosh, and everything's set. That's my plan.
I'm you know I remember a lot of the academics in my school looking at how I dealt with life going, gee, you're never going to become an academic because you're too practical. And I said, thank goodness somebody has to be practical, because otherwise who's going to translate, like you just mentioned, what's in a book to reality?
Yeah, I think, I mean, and that really is the difference between the sexuality education that just sort of like introduces you to the concept of thinking about sexuality and even contemplating doing something, like first part of stages of change theory. Right. And then the actual, all right, so it's Wednesday at 6 o'clock. This is what's happening. Like, what are we going to do about it? Yeah. So, I mean, when, if somebody comes to you as a client, is your level of involvement like this very practical sort of?
I'm extremely practical. I do not do hands-on.
Okay.
I had thought about that, but that crosses a boundary in like Pennsylvania.
Body work or?
Yeah, okay. Body work or even showing somebody how to do something.
Okay.
People stay fully clothed. I discuss it. But it seems to work because nobody has ever come back after, you know, I hate using the word homework assignment, but I do give assignments to people because they really want to know what the next step is. And I'm pretty clear. Nobody's ever come back going, you didn't describe that well. It didn't work. I've actually never had anybody say that. So I must be pretty clear. And I always make sure before somebody goes out the door that they verbally have explained exactly what I said to them.
Mm-hmm.
So in their own words, if it doesn't sound right, I then explain it differently mm-hmm. so that they understand. And I shouldn't say most of the time, but it is most of the time I deal with couples. And they tend to be hetero, although I'm not exclusive that way, just the psychologists that I deal with, that's probably their client base. And so people want to know quite often. I get young couples sometimes who all they've heard about, if they've had sex ed in school, all they've heard about are all the negatives or all the STIs they can get and how to deal with precautions, which is all wonderful. But there's never a word of pleasure.
No.
And, you know, you get a guy who is used to pleasuring himself and now there's a different part of the anatomy that's supposed to pleasure him and it's not working because it doesn't feel the same. You know, you have a guy who's wired his brain to have an orgasm with his hand, but now you're going inside a vagina that doesn't feel like his hand. So you get a lot of mismatching that way and how to change that and how to make it work. And it's not something that happens overnight because that rewiring has taken a period of time.
Yeah, and the masturbatory conditioning isn't, I mean, it's the hand is obviously a significant element of it, that you're controlling the pace and the,
right.
the all of those things. But, I mean, often people masturbate in a specific room, maybe sitting or laying in a specific way that they just get used to. And then, you know, when you're actually hooking up with somebody, odds are good you're not going to be in your regular on your desk chair, wherever it is,
right. And your space
with your 6 tabs open.
You know, and I help people to integrate toys, aids, whatever name you want to call them, because for many different reasons, either because there's a boredom factor involved and they want to spice it up in that manner. Also adding erotica, visuals, you know, many different things. And getting over the fact that this is not replacing anything. This is enhancing. And sometimes there's a psychological factor involved there, and so we have to discuss that. So there, I sort of feel like I'm a fly on the wall sometimes. And that's where they want me to be, which is fine. Because they come in and they tell me very specifically what they've done and also how they feel about it. And what's nice is, even though I ask them to do that with each other privately, quite often things come out that are very different in an environment when there's a third person. And all of a sudden, I'll hear the male or the female part of the relationship go, I didn't know that about you. Or, I wish I had known that. Or, you know, many different voices start appearing and saying things that they then go home and work with that. I've never had anyone leave me because it just didn't, the matchup didn't work out. I give so much information that I'm thinking is out there, but who can read it all and who can find it all? It's so much easier to have someone work not just giving you the information, but tailoring it to you, to your needs.
Well, so obviously now people have two different venues through which to tap into all these things. Either they can go on a date to the literary salon. Do people go on dates there?
Oh, absolutely. It's a great date. Actually, I had one man bring his 21-year-old son for his birthday.
Oh, my.
And they had a great time. People do come on dates, and people come singly. I mean, it's... Nobody comes there. Well, I'm going to take that back. I usually give a bit of a directive, if I remember, at intermission, and I ask people to talk to somebody they have never spoken to before. That's a permission giver. Mm-hmm. You get out there, you're allowed to do that. Since people show up early at 6:30, there's a 45-minute slot. I roam around, I talk to people, I do that connection. Nobody ever feels isolated coming there. It's a really, I mean, the feedback that I have gotten both in emails that come to me or on various meetup sites when people leave testimonies is that they're always surprised by the comfort level and the supportive community. I always hear that. And I guess I have no way of putting that down on my flyer to get people to understand that it's, even though I say it's a comfortable, safe space, nobody believes it till they're there. They can't imagine it being that way. But the reality is, you know, people feel that way once they're there.
All right. So if somebody wants to come to the Erotic Literary Salon, what are the details? How? Where do they go?
Well,
how do they find out more?
Probably the best detail is to go to the website, which I know it sounds pretentious, but it's theeroticliterarysalon.com. And that's two E's for the and erotic. Gives all the guidelines because you do have to sign up in advance. I want people to know that it's 5 minutes. There's the email address is there. And that's the best way to find out about it. I also blog daily, not just about what's going on at the salon. In fact, I say very little about that. I have a newsletter that goes out, which you can subscribe to on the site. That's sent out bi-monthly. But I blog about sex news with a sex positive spin, and for everybody who thinks they were ever positive, they will find out they probably are not when it comes to reading a lot of articles. And also about events, sometimes international events of importance, and quite often events around Philadelphia.
So that's all on the same website?
All on the same website. Mm-hmm.
And if anybody wants to go to you for relationship mentoring?
Well, even on that website, if you go to my bio, it'll take you to Susanna, S-U-S-A-N-A, Mayer, M-A-Y-E-R.com.
Awesome.
I also have the book. I don't think I mentioned recently I published the book that is the template of the salon. About 3/4 of it is filled with authors that I've read at the salon. There are 50 authors, and the book's called Sen Sexual, S-E-N-S-E-X-U-A-L, a unique anthology, 2013. It is dedicated to my 96-year-old mom, who has a lot of her works in there. And you can actually read some of them if you go to Amazon for the book. It is an ebook, you can a Kindle book, and you can get a free app, so you can read it on anything. They give out free apps now. And you can read as samples some of her work there, and you'll be astounded. She's pretty out there.
Feisty.
Yeah.
I like it.
She is.
All right. Well, thank you so much for what has been absolutely inspirational chat about a whole lot of sexy stuff. So thank you very much, Dr. Susanna Mayer, for joining us. Everybody go check out the Erotic Literary Salon. The next one's May 21st.
May 21st. It's always, always, always the third Tuesday. That doesn't go by weeks. It's the third Tuesday of every month.
And this will be the 5-year anniversary party.
Oh, it's going to be great because Irene Ranke is going to be doing a a new style of dance that she's performed there before, and it's a cross between tribal belly dancing and flamenco.
Nice.
It's really, really quite wonderful.
And some absinthe, from what I hear.
Oh, yes, absinthe, for certain.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you, everyone, for listening, and have a wonderful day. Thank you for listening to Sex with Timmery. Sex with Timmery, the podcast, is produced by Nathan Karuna. Our opening music is by Charles Evans. Our closing music is by Hanya Lee. Be sure to check out sexwithtimmery.com, Sex with Timmery on Facebook, and tweet at me, Timmery_LEIGH. If you're a fan of the show, if you like it at all, a little bit maybe even, rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends all about it. And thank you.